It was a warm day just this August when I jumped out of a car at Broadway and 106th, Upper West Side, Manhattan, looking for a little slice of Titanic history that, to be quite honest, I have felt uneasy about. I hadn't been in the city for over a decade until this trip, and the days before, we'd been hopping around to show the kids as much as we possibly could. A New York summer vacation. I'd snuck in a trip to Chelsea Piers under the auspices of playing on Little Island, but my children quickly discovered I'd been trying to make it to the pier, where Carpathia came in with survivors, of course. They forgave me and were not shocked. And now here I was, husband and kids napping back at the hotel on this solemn mission to chase down the life of two of the ship's most mythological figures. Truly. Ida, known to her family sometimes as Rosalie, her real first name, and Isidore Strauss, had a home on Broadway between 105th and 106th Streets. And now Pocket Park, a tiny respite from the city, commemorates them. If you don't know who they were, you might miss the story altogether in this park. When I was there, with fellow Titanic enthusiast Nelson Aspen, who was waiting for me patiently on a bench with a warm and welcoming smile, we talked with some of the families in the neighborhood. Nelson used to live nearby. Some knew who the Strausses were. Some didn't. A dry cleaner's nearby still bears their name. I gave my business card to a couple who said they used to take their Christmas cards in front of the reclining statue, whose model, Audrey Munson, was very arguably America's first supermodel. Her form debuted in marble statuary, The Three Graces, which was unveiled in the new grand ballroom at the Hotel Astor in Times Square in September of 1909. Her image was so coveted that she'd reflected in sculpture all over the city. She was part of the city. But her life was tumultuous, to say the very least. She lived until 1996, but for 65 of her years, she was in a psychiatric facility. On the memorial is carved a passage from 2 Samuel. Lovely and pleasant were they in their lives, and in their death, they were not parted. And an odd combination I found that to be in statuary. The Strausses were New York society, the co-owners of Macy's department store, of course, a bastion of the city's culture and its day-to-day lifeblood. They were also both Jewish immigrants whose childhoods began on opposing sides of the nation's most important and most horrid conflict. Their love story is watered down in Titanic mythology. It is. And their lives summed up in that moment that Ida decided to stay on the ship with her husband doesn't do them justice. The docile Pocket Park is a bit of verdant green in the concrete. Being immortalized is a wild concept, and sometimes it leaves you stuck in stone. There's so much more purpose in this story than all of that, and nothing docile at all. Love, global politics, history, the horrors of the Civil War, there's all of it here. The American story, writ small and writ large. I'm LA Beatles, and this is Unsinkable, the Titanic podcast. This is Where You Go, I Go, the story of Ida and Isidore Strauss. Hey guys, just a quick warning at the front end here. If you are listening with children, or if you're someone that may be triggered by these things, want to let you know there is a pretty blunt discussion in this episode of the system of slavery in the U.S. South and some of the brutalities and very hard details involved with slavery. So just a warning, I know a lot of people listen with kiddos in the car. This may not be the best episode for that. So there you go. Just a little warning. I want to begin, as always, by extending a huge thank you to my newest Patreon supporters. Thank you, Claire Nix. Thank you, The Glipper. Thank you, Alice Wepner. Thank you, Laura Stevenson. Thank you, Lindsay Garrett. Thank you, Rudolph Rem. Thank you, Gina Dunn. And thank you, Sonia Kames. If I have pronounced anyone's name incorrectly, or I have missed anyone over the course of the last month or so, please let me know so I can get your proper shout out or fix your shout out. As always, a little bit of a plug for Patreon from your favorite independent, non-underwear ad running podcaster. I want desperately to keep this podcast free of random ads. I really only want to ethically advertise, which for me means either advertising other podcasts through my Buzzsprout, through the system that I use for hosting, which is Buzzsprout, or with actual Titanic products, places, museums, that sort of thing. So Patreon is a wonderful way to support the podcast if you've become a fan. And now is a really good time to join because there are 2 years of backlogged bonus episodes just sitting there now. So if you join now, you've got a lot of content to uncover. And also, there is a new feature on Patreon. It's brand new that allows you to go ahead and pay for the whole year up front at a pretty good discount. I believe it's like 10 or 15%. So if you are a fan of the podcast, and you are able, I know that's a lot to ask someone to spend money on a podcast, but if you have become a fan and it's something you're able to do, please do. I'm so thankful for all of my supporters, and I'm working really hard to get you guys even more exclusive content. Okay, I'll shut up. Typical pitch for you. I've learned to shorten it. I don't want to go on too long about those things, but Patreon is there waiting for you with some really cool bonus episodes if you like. Book club episode is on the way with Patty Henry, who wrote the novel Surviving Savannah, which is a fictionalization of the shipwreck of what many call the Titanic of the South, the Pulaski. That will be in your feed next week. We've already done the interview and it was fantastic. Next week might be a double release because I also have a really cool collaborative episode with Paul Carganilla, who is a Titaniac and also an entertainer, a podcaster himself. Check out his podcast, Cove. I'll link it in the show notes. We did a collaborative episode where we sort of interviewed each other about our Titanic stories and ended up getting into a really meaningful and I think quite moving conversation about why all of this inspires us. So that will also be releasing very soon. And there will be an episode on his feed and on mine. They're similar, but you should check out both of those. A couple of spooky season podcast recommendations. Uncanny, hosted by Danny Robbins, which is through the BBC, is back with another season where he investigates hauntings and reports of ghostly apparitions. And he does this really amazing thing of assembling a panel of experts to break down the claims. But he also does really compassionate interviews with the people who have remembered a sighting or have dealt with some sort of haunting. And there's a lot of history in there as well. Great British accents to boot. So if you're in the mood for some spooky season podcasts, I highly recommend that one. Also, Haunted Road, which is hosted by Amy Bruni, who I really admire. She has a show called Kindred Spirits. It's on Discovery. She is a writer. She is, some people would say ghost hunter, but I don't think that's the right word, and I don't think that's what she would use to describe herself. She's more in the realm of a medium who works to investigate hauntings and also provide support, emotional and psychological, to people who are dealing with them. And she has a long history with them as well. She's great. I recommend picking up her books too. But I think that that is coming back for a fifth season very shortly. So just a couple of recommendations. I've been trying to stay up on that resolution to make sure I'm also recommending other podcasts. All right. So the Strausses have long been a request from listeners, and I've admittedly turned away from this episode many times before. When I had historian Gareth Russell on the show almost 2 years ago now, which is hard to believe, we touched on Isidore Strauss's involvement with the Confederacy, and it became clear to me that to do an episode on him would not be some mythical, clean process. The Strausses are embedded in Titanic mythology like none other, the sacred couple, untouchable because their love has seemingly touched and inspired so many people. But I'm a Southern historian, and just as I would expect any historian, a historian of the South or of anywhere, too, I must unpack the lives of this historic couple with as much accuracy and as much contextual honesty as I can. I owe that to myself and I owe that to you. I will not polish down the sharp edges of this story just to prevent ruffling feathers. That's not what I do. The Civil War is the most important and impactful event in American history. The legacy of American slavery is the most important and impactful and sadly horrific chapter of American history, and its legacies are nowhere near gone. We live with them every single day. Both Ida and Isidore, as Gareth Russell pointed out in his book, The Ship of Dreams, which has some great segments on the Strausses, were also first-generation Americans, both having come to the country as children. And it is this theme that is perhaps most compelling as a way to frame their stories alongside what is also this crucial theme of the Civil War and slavery. So those two will work as frameworks. Also, they both shared an identity as Jewish immigrants and as Jewish then Americans. So there are these threads that, as a historian, and this is always, it's weird to say good after I just mentioned those complex things, but it's always a really good feeling when themes emerge, because when you have threads and themes that fit together really well, it's so much easier to tell the story in a way that's accessible for everybody. And I think in this situation, there are a lot of themes that will keep popping up. Isidore's father, Lazarus, came from a Jewish family in Otterburg, then under the Kingdom of Bavaria. He sided with uprisings in 1848. I don't know a lot about Bavarian history, German history, or the history of this part of the world during this era, to be honest at all. So I am struggling to make sure I give you a good summary here. But there was a wave of political and societal upheaval and unrest, and from my understanding, it was part of an industrial downturn. But the government survived, which made it hard for the opposition, those that had been directly opposed to the government during those uprisings, to then live in the country. Also around this time, in his very large family, there were inheritance disputes among the men in the family. And so historians point at these two reasons for why around 1850, Lazarus decided to leave his wife Sarah and six young children, including Isidore, behind, going ahead to America to save money to bring them all over to join him. He went first to Philadelphia, which is long a place of German immigration to North America, and then down to Georgia. He worked as a peddler, which sounds a certain way to modern ears, but in the 19th century, it was actually a pretty crucial role, a pretty crucial job in the United States South, where plantations were very spread out, miles and miles and miles, and women who ran households were very limited on interactions and products that they could purchase. Isidore always said that his father gushed over Southern hospitality and how welcome he was. But of course, we know now that seeming graciousness of rich white Southerners was at best a thing to mask darkness, and at worst, the tool of some of the region's most egregious masters to win their neighbors and colleagues over while they reigned over a bloody and repressive empire of cotton or lumber that would not have survived without the enslavement of Black people. It took Lazarus 2 years to save enough money to bring his family over. Isadora, born in 1845, was just a few years old. They settled in Talbotton, Georgia, northeast of Columbus, and opened a store where they sold goods. The family spoke openly about feeling less anti-Semitism in the U.S. South than in the North. Methodist and Baptist preachers frequented their home, often bustling their home was by all accounts, and over dinner, these preachers would ask Lazarus to help translate the Old Testament from the original Hebrew. So this sounds all sounds fine and dandy, right? Everyone hanging out together across religions. But what we can also see now, and what the family probably knew even then, I would bet, is that their white skin trumped all. A core development in the history of class in America is that being white trumped anything else. The system at the center of Southern life was slavery, and for slavery to remain accepted, and guys, this is just very basic historiography, to continue to fuel the Southern economy, for everyone to buy into this horrific system, whites had to continue to see in each other and convince each other of a shared superiority. Otherwise, the house of cards would fall like nothing before, and of course it's going to start to fall pretty soon. Remember, at this point in history, there are literally preachers, pastors, who worked daily very hard to convince their constituents that slavery was not only necessary, but somehow good, selling false and unspeakable narratives about African savagery or nonsense science. Isadore ignored the subject of slavery in his own writings, it seems, but his brother Oscar wrote that he thought his parents were not really 100% on board with the concept. This, though, rails against the facts of the thing, because the facts are that Lazarus and Sarah Strauss owned at least 12 slaves, if not more, and bought and sold them freely. Oscar insisted that some slaves from other homes begged his parents to buy them, and that the Strauss home was more open and happy and permissive to slaves than others in the area. There is, in family writings, a sense that the Strausses were some incarnation of a more ideal slaver. It's very treacherous to even insinuate, though, that there could ever be such a thing as a better slaver. That is an oxymoron, and never let anyone else in the world try to convince you that that is possible. Oscar admitted that because he grew up in it, in slavery, he never questioned the validity of it, especially as a child. The brothers worked for their father, and the company became L. Strauss and Sons, and enslaved persons were a part of their household. And here we have the scariest intersection of Isadore's history. The macro, of course, the Civil War and the brother against brother, the ridiculously bloody conflict that tore so much to shreds, but ultimately led to the emancipation of America's Black population. That's the macro. The micro here is, as a teenager, Isadore, who, as much as students of Titanic don't want to think about it, so sorry, he attended slave auctions for his family with his brother and wrote about getting, on one occasion, a, quote, 2-for-1 deal because he and his brother, I believe it was Nathan, bought a female who was pregnant. Let that sink in. This was still significantly less than 200 years ago, and this is American history, which is sometimes just awfully abysmal. There is no excuse for participating in the system of human slavery, even though Southern historians have tried on many occasions for many, many years to come up with some. I won't give them credence here. There's no excuse. And with Isidore, it gets worse before it gets better, unfortunately. As the war progressed, the Northern Navy blockaded Southern harbors. Nothing in, nothing out. The cotton typically exported to Europe, for example, this was a staple process in the Southern economy. And if that's shut off, you have whole systems shut down. Businessmen in the South who, let me repeat, built their businesses as slaveholders and on top of an economy that would never have blossomed or given them this wealth without slave labor as every part of its fabric, they were frenetic and worried. The system that they had bought into, the system that allowed them to wear silk ties, right, is falling apart. Isidore made the active and rather risky decision to work as a blockade runner. In other words, to skirt around northern blockades and sneak supplies in and out to a metaphorically and now sometimes literally starving South. He went to New York, where he first stopped to deliver messages to another Jewish family he knew, the Blunds, whose elder daughter had married a Southerner and had not been able to hear from her because of the war. He delivered messages from her. And there he met their younger daughter, Rosalie Ida, just 14 at the time to Isidore's 18. She'd been born in Germany, but also immigrated to the U.S. as a small child. This was 1863, in the immediate aftermath of the Battle of Gettysburg. In the North, Black men and women were being lynched, as some Northerners blamed them for the war. In the South, Black men and women were being lynched for desertion, for attempting to flee to free territories, for anything that you could imagine they were being punished for. The Confederacy saw the writing on the wall, stripped down, cut off, and outdone by the Union. And Isidore wrote letters home from London, where he was working to secure ships for blockade runners, telling his family to buy no more slaves and to buy as much land as possible. He worked to aid a London-based Confederate agent while living in England as well. And he worked as a Confederate bond salesman in London and in Amsterdam. This is all more than the, oh, the Strausses just happen to be from the South. It's way more than that. Lazarus closed his shop around this time, fed up with growing anti-Semitism that painted Jewish Southerners as straddlers, betraying the South or vice versa by still working with each side. The Strausses decamped to Columbus to a house there. And even after the war, Lazarus, steadfast in his business ethic, I will say that, insisted his family work hard to repay all pre-war debts, which honestly, most Southerners never did. Isidore eventually went back to New York, as did most of his family following him. And Lazarus set up shop there, took all of his experience and put it to work for him in New York City. He convinced Rowland Hussey Macy, who founded Macy's department store, to allow him and his sons to open a crockery department in the basement. This would eventually become the glass and china department. Rowland Hussey Macy's journey in the retail industry began in the mid-19th century when he opened several dry goods stores, including the original Macy's store in Haverhill, Massachusetts in 1851. Just a little department store history for you. Despite initial failures, Macy gained valuable insights from these experiences, and in 1858, he relocated to New York City, establishing R.H. Macy & Co., on 6th Avenue, a location quite distant from other dry goods stores of that same era. In October of 1858, the store's first day of business, it generated a modest $11 in sales. His early emblem was a rooster, later replaced by the iconic red star in 1862. Bear with me because I'm going to jump back and forth on the timeline in terms of Isidore a little bit here with this business stuff. As the business thrived, Macy's expanded into adjacent buildings, offering diverse departments, retail innovations. They were the first to have Santa Claus. They had themed exhibits and illuminated window displays, a money-back guarantee. Macy's quickly gained popularity and expanded its offerings. It introduced fixed price tags, which eliminated once and for all haggling over prices in stores. And this practice revolutionized retail. They also had custom clothing on site. In 1875, Macy took on partners, Robert Valentine and Abel LaForge. What a name. But tragically, they both passed away within a few years. So ownership stayed within the Macy family until 1895, when it was acquired by the Strauss brothers, Isidore and Nathan. Most Titanic histories don't mention Nathan, who had been by his brother's side in business since the slave auction block. The brothers also acquired a completely different store, which was originally called Welschler and Abraham, and it became Abraham and Strauss, a dry goods store that evolved into a department store as well, with cloth and silks and upholsteries and silver, anything you could imagine, house furnishings. But that was a kind of a separate entity. It wasn't officially a part of Macy's, but the stores shared an overseas office and maintained close ties. Obviously, they were run by the same group. In 1871, Isidore and Ida had gotten married. They had seven children, one of whom very tragically passed away at only the age of two. That was little Clarence. When they were apart, as Isidore traveled much for work, they apparently wrote to one another daily. Ida would talk to her friends about darning Isidore's socks lovingly, even though by this point they were certainly more than wealthy enough to pay someone else to do those sorts of things. They doted on one another, and even though still conforming generally to gender dynamics of the time period, were progressive in many ways in the equality of their marriage and interactions and in their parenting. Ida was known as the consummate New York hostess, and she entertained some of the most progressive and brilliant women in the city at the time. Their daughters received equal education to their sons, which even in the late 1800s was huge, which is wild to think about how recent that was a big deal. Recently, that was a big deal. They did public school fundraising. They worked actively to combat poverty in boroughs like Brooklyn. Isidore was on the board for the Montefiore Home for Chronic Invalids and the Manhattan Hospital, as well as the Hebrew Orphans Society. He was treasurer of the Clara de Hirsch Home for Working Girls. These names, I mean, they were all doing good work, it sounds like, but these names, they just don't age well. They co-founded the Educational Alliance in 1889 to help immigrants. The Strauss' wealth in 1912 was estimated conservatively at $3.5 million, which would be almost $110 million today, but was probably even more. When Mutual Alliance Trust Company opened for business in New York on June 29th, 1902, there were 13 directors, including Emmanuel Lehman, William Rockefeller, Cornelius Vanderbilt, and Isidore Strauss. He turned down the notion of becoming Postmaster General. I found some really entertaining articles from the New York Times around this time where businessmen were just debating openly in the newspaper whether they thought Strauss would be a good Postmaster General, and they seemed to agree that he would, but he did not want to do it. He was a Democratic congressman for New York's 15th district. He replaced someone who could not finish their term. He advocated for English as a second language. He was a champion of immigration, but also a champion of assimilation, funding new immigrant education programs in the city. He hadn't been born in America, but he was decidedly American in his own eyes, in the mirror, and that emotion is so much of the American story and how he saw himself. I think we're blinded by rage generally now in this country and have lost sight of the fact that quite literally we were all there on that precipice at some point, our ancestors were at least, at some point of being an immigrant, strangers in a strange land. The Strauss family remained, sadly, as all Jewish families globally did and still do, aware of the prejudice that followed them. Isidore's youngest brother, Isaac, was the first Jewish man to serve in the U.S. cabinet, actually, as Secretary of Commerce and Labor under the first Roosevelt administration. He'd also been a U.S. minister abroad, but anti-Semitism in places like Russia and Switzerland made it difficult for him to travel. Isidore's brother Nathan had been denied a hotel room in New Jersey once, One of Ida and Isidore's grandchildren were rejected at St. Bernard's Academy, a Manhattan prep school. The rejection letter, even after Isidore's attempts at intervention, even after he was worth more than $3 million, said, quote, "We should lose out on genteel pupils were we to accept Hebrews." The Strauss's work with immigrant organizations was crucial as pogroms and prejudices against Jews increased in Eastern Europe and more of them moved to America. This, unshockingly and unfortunately, led to more anti-Semitism in this country. What's interesting is that Isidore was not a heavily practicing Jew and hadn't been for quite some time, nor did he keep a traditional Jewish diet. But his identity as a Jewish immigrant was obviously important to him and all of his work. Workers at Macy's sing the praises of the couple as compassionate employers, and there's actually a plaque in Macy's dedicated to them to this day. I wish I'd had a chance to see it while I was in New York, but unfortunately, I didn't. Ida experienced heart problems as she aged, attributed by Isidore and doctors apparently, all male of course, as nervous complaints. Isidore was often heard asking her to slow down and spend more time on herself. Who knows if perhaps she had an improperly diagnosed condition, or maybe some of it was just anxiety, but they'd taken to vacationing in the spring, at least partly to help her nerves, a 1912 version of self-care, albeit one with massive ocean liners and never-ending European social engagements. They boarded the Cunard Line's Caronia in January of 1912, stopping first in Cannes, though through letters we know that most of their time in the Riviera that year was actually full of rain. They were pelted the entire time. The Strausses boarded Titanic at Southampton for the return trip with Ida's maid, Ellen Bird, and Isidore's valet, John Farthing. Ellen Bird was 31 years old, a native of Norfolk. She was a farmer's daughter, one of 11 children. And Ellen, along with the majority of her siblings, went out to work at a very young age, and by the time of the 1901 census, was listed as a general domestic at an address in Kingston-on-Thames, Surrey. Bird had been living in London when the Strausses interviewed her. This was a very recent employment. They had gone from the Riviera to London. Ida's maid Marie had quit during their time on the Riviera. She'd met a barber while there and stayed behind to marry him. Isidore apparently told family members he was, quote, disgusted with the girl. It sort of sounds to me like Marie was chasing her dreams or love or maybe trying to just start over a new leaf and leave service behind. Who knows? Maybe let's cut her a break historically when we look back. The Strausses had been trying to find a new French maid to bring back with them. They had very little success in interviewing anyone, but did hire a British maid, Ellen. They hired a British maid who deserted them last minute. And then Ellen's interview was right before they boarded Titanic. So can you imagine? It's just wild. In a letter from Ida Strauss to her children, she said the quote, "new girl," she had high hopes for her working out. And all of this just reminds us, you know, lest we ever forget, that the Strausses are obviously kind and compassionate people with a lot of down-to-earth personality traits, but they are still in the upper echelon of society at the time and very much lived up to the cliches of such a role. You know, great discussion invested in servants and their comportments, for example. So they bumped up their return and were on Titanic and not Olympic. And actually think they may have originally been on another ship that wasn't Olympic and then Titanic. But because their son, Jesse, who was one of the older children and had his own family at this point and was very instrumental in running Macy's, needed time off with his own wife and family. And they were actually headed to Europe. So they'd attempted a recent renovation of the sixth floor of the flagship Macy's, trying out a section with more affordable items, and it hadn't performed as well as they'd hoped. So it was, I think, stressing everybody out a lot. And Isidore, even as he approached age 67, you know, an age when most people in his society circles would consider retiring, he still had a driving vision for the business that he'd helped to build. And so he was headed back to work on this sixth floor renovation and another component of the business, I'm sure, and relieve his son for a few months. I think sometimes we visualize the Strausses as the old couple in the bed at the end of the movie, of the 97 movie. We infantilize them. And we tend to infantilize older adults more generally, which just is horrible. Jesse and his family would actually pass close enough on their ship, the German liner, the America, during Titanic's voyage for the family to all pass telegrams around. America would actually be one of the ships to warn Titanic of the ice fields on the 14th. The telegram the Strausses sent to their son on April 14th, Sunday, of course, said this: "Fine voyage, fine ship, feeling fine. What news?" Fine voyage, fine ship, feeling fine. I sort of love the jauntiness of that. I think they were in a good mood. The Strausses had a parlor suite, C55 and C57, which most of you know was a bedroom, a drawing room, a bathroom, and a large wardrobe. This is the type of suite that Rose and Cal and Ruth had in the 97 movie. The drawing room, almost identical to these suites on Titanic's sister ship Olympic, was decorated in the Regency era, but with modern updates. Walls of mahogany panels studded with candelabras, a fireplace, but with an electric heater. The shared bedroom with two twin beds was actually a sign that they were very fond of one another. It seems clinical now, sharing a room was considered a very intimate act on sea voyages for very elite couples at this time. Most of them wanted their own room. Lillian Burbridge, who was the wife of the director of the Harrods department stores, left flowers for the Strausses in their room. While they'd been in London, they'd spent time with the couple. They'd gone to the theater and to dinners. Isidore liked keeping in touch with his German relatives, and he and Ida both loved London and trips to the Riviera. So these trips across the Atlantic by this time were so common as to warrant probably very little fanfare upon actual boarding of a ship, but this was Titanic, and I imagine there had to be at least a slight acknowlediging to one another of being on the maiden voyage of this ship. Though, as I've mentioned before, its twin Olympic had already been on the sea for some time, so for some seasoned passengers, there's maybe a chance Titanic seemed already an expected run-of-the-mill thing. I don't know. Who knows? That said, Isidore, by all accounts, appreciated every rivet of a vessel when he was on it. Violet Jessop, well-known surviving stewardess on Titanic, recalls seeing Ida and Isidore on the voyage as, quote, "a delightful old couple, old in years and young in character, whom we were always happy to see join us." And this is worth mentioning because, as we all know, at the time and still now, there is often a propensity for the uber wealthy to be less than warm and compassionate towards service workers. We know that they took a walk after boarding in Southampton, not only because Jessop recalls interacting with them, but also because Colonel Archibald Gracie does as well. Gracie came from a Confederate legacy too. In fact, he boarded Titanic, pushing copies of his tome about the Battle of Chickamauga, which his father fought in before perishing at Petersburg in 1864. He handed Isidore a copy, and by Sunday afternoon, Isidore would hand it back to him, claiming to have completed it. I don't know about you, but I suspect Isidore read that book the same way I read some of the 600-page monographs during my comps period in grad school. I should mention here that a lot of the information we have about the Strausses on board Titanic is from Gracie's memoir. And in this segment, he makes it seem as if two former Confederates are just smoking cigars on the back porch with some sweet tea, reminiscing about the good old days and valor, yada, yada, yada. I'll leave Gracie's story for another day, but there's a dangerous amount of lost cause conviction in Gracie's story and writing sometimes. But not in Isidore's. As I said, he did not write about it, and I don't get that sense from him at all. Ida returned to their suite to write a letter of thanks for the flowers, which would leave the ship at Cherbourg. in the mail, of course. It's a few paragraphs in which she calls Titanic, quote, huge and so magnificently appointed. While she did this, Isidore returned back to announce the near collision with the ship, the New York, in Southampton Harbor. Remember, this is the ship that the moorings ripped off, and it and Titanic almost had a collision right there at Southampton, which, if it had happened, would have prevented everything. Isidore actually had a connection to the New York, the ship. He'd been on its maiden voyage 25 years earlier. Gareth Russell points this out. Excellent, amazing research, Gareth. And it was, Ida was writing this letter when he comes in to announce us. And we know that because it's in the letter that he's interrupting her to announce this. And Ida continued to write. It's a really long letter when you consider it's mostly just to thank someone for flowers. And it's another reminder to me that I would have personally had very little patience for the manners and all the minutiae required of wealthy people at this time. The Strausses had daily walks with Gracie and likely other families on board. To Isidore's credit, he does not seem to have, like I said, waxed nostalgic about the Old South so much as Gracie did. And it's worth noting that he'd remade himself into something decidedly un-Southern at this point. The ethical dilemma as a historian, and just as a person really, is to try and reconcile the two eras of his life. I won't try to do that for you. I have that going on in my own head, and I can't do that for you, but I wanted to have the information presented. I want you to have the information to think about these things and think about the nuances. It's entirely possible he regretted his involvement in the war, in the institution of slavery, which all happened when he was very young. It's possible in private he spoke of these things. We just will never know. The night of the sinking, the collision woke Ida and her maid, who went straight to her employer as they heard the stewards talk of icebergs. And so, of course, Isidore is up at this point as well. Ida roused John, Isidore's valet, and began to pile on clothes. She put on two coats, her wedding ring, and filled a large pouch with jewelry. We know that Isidore put on leather gloves at this point. What a intimate visual. No one in their group felt immediate danger. As we've discussed here many times over, the first class passengers didn't at this point, and they sat on steamer chairs awaiting instructions. And then they end up at lifeboat 8 for this mythological scene we all know. Lifeboat 8 was launched under Lightoller with Captain Smith and Officer Wilde also close by. This is the lifeboat that Archibald Butt puts Marie Young in, wraps her in the blankets. I don't know if you remember that story. This was a boat full of mostly single women. Mostly a lot of elite single women. Isidore is actually offered a spot, and several accounts point this out, because of his age. And he says very definitively, no, I will not get in until women and children are all off the boat. There's a few variations of exactly the words that he spoke, but everybody agrees that that's what he said. In chapter 2 of Gracie's The Truth About Titanic, his memoir, the men tried to get Mrs. Strauss, Ida, into the boat, but she wouldn't go. And then they offered Isidore a spot as to encourage them both to get in. And this is when this epic and really one of the only non-debated parts of the Titanic story. I mean, we'll debate till the cows come home about what the final song the band played was or where Thomas Andrews was at the end of the night, but nobody fights the fact that this happened with the Strausses. So then Ida turned back and rejoined her husband, and she said, according to Gracie and others at the boat, quote, we have lived together for many years. Where you go, I go. And again, people around that boat tried to persuade her, but she refused to get in the boat. And the Strausses went and sat together on a pair of deck chairs. In the middle of all of this, Ida handed Ellen Bird, her maid, some of her jewelry, then decided to take it back. She also gave Ellen her fur coat, saying that she wouldn't be needing it. And Ellen survived in lifeboat 8 in the coat. After being rescued, just to note, Ellen tried to give the fur coat back to the family, specifically to Sarah Strauss Hess, who was the oldest daughter of the Strausses. But Sarah told Ellen that that was hers, that, you know, she'd given it to, that Ida had given it to Ellen, and she should keep it. The romantic notion of the Strausses then returning to their cabins together, which is shown in the 97 movie, I think that's largely mythology, though. Even though they openly resigned to stay on the ship together, this does not, in my opinion, necessarily mean they resigned to die immediately. There had to have been some amount of hoping that rescue was still possible. Gracie is our main source on these scenes, and his trauma and grief combined with his propensity to write on a grand dramatic scale, let's say, it just can be a little problematic as a source. John Farthing, the valet, did unfortunately die and his body was never found. He was from Suffolk. He was 49 years old. He had worked as a butler in England for many years and then immigrated to the United States in 1903 and may have worked for Isidore for almost 10 years, it is believed. He was married to a woman named Thirza Richmond, who was originally from Germany. Isidore's body was found by the Mackay Bennett, the rescue ship. He was body number 96, male. I'm going to read the description in the logbook. Male. Estimated age 65, front gold tooth, partly, gray hair and mustache, clothing, fur-lined overcoat, gray trousers, coat and vest, soft striped shirt, brown boots, black silk socks. Effects: pocketbook, gold watch, platinum and pearl chain, gold pencil case, silver flask, silver salts bottle, and 40 pounds in notes, and two silver coins, I believe that's what that says. First class name, Isidore Strauss. And on him was a locket with pictures of his children, Jesse and Sarah, which his great-great-grandson is still in possession of and makes the rounds at the museums. 40,000 people were there for the couple's memorial service. It was held in New York City. There were eulogies by, I think, 8 people, including Andrew Carnegie. In the New York Times, quote, "The funeral of Isidore Strauss, who died on the wreck of the Titanic, was held at noon yesterday at the family residence, an old frame house at 105th Street and Broadway, which is one of the landmarks of early New York. In order to avoid a great outpouring of many friends and admirers of the late merchant and philanthropist, no publicity has been given to the fact that the funeral was to take place, and only members of the Strauss family attended. The services were conducted by the Reverend Dr. Samuel Shulman, Rabbi of Temple Bethel, 5th Avenue and 76th Street, according to the simple but impressive Hebrew ritual." 2 years later, a second service was on Strauss Square, Broadway, and 107th Street, of course, Pocket Park, that is still there. The story of Ida and Isidore's bravery and loyalty was celebrated in a lot of places for a lot of reasons. Rabbis told their congregations about the sacrifice. There were articles in Yiddish and German-speaking newspapers. A popular song featured their story. It was called The Titanic's Disaster, and it was very popular in Jewish communities. As historian Stephen Beale pointed out in his cultural history, Down with the Old Canoe, the cultural history of Titanic, moral conservatives, interestingly, of the early 20th century almost immediately latched onto the story to back their efforts to maintain women's marginalization. Bet you didn't expect to hear that one. Divorce rates were on the rise. Gee, I wonder why. As was just women's activism in general, the suffrage movement was in full swing. Early feminism, you name it, women were moving and shaking and getting shit done. And men, Officials, religious organizations grounded in keeping women in the home and without rights use stories like Ida's to illustrate the sacred bonds of marriage and the value of love to conquer all. So just to be clear, the Strauss romantic tale was first used in society to go against women's fights for easier divorce laws. And men wrote poems about the Strauss love, men who wanted women in their place. Now, to note, women also played a huge role in the building of Titanic's heroic manhood narrative, even working to fund a memorial that used that exact phrase. And when I speak so much about the masculine Anglo hero narrative in Titanic, I'm not making it up, you guys. I'm not exaggerating. It was there in 1912 and it's still with us. And there we go. Somewhere out there in the distance, I can just hear someone writing a hate review for the podcast because of this, but go ahead. I don't care. I'm going to tell you the truth. Walter Lord looked in on the Strausses in his narrative, A Night to Remember, of course. He has them reminiscing about their life, and this puts them firmly in the Titanic canon. So they appear in 1953's Hollywood Titanic, 1958's A Night to Remember film adaptation, 1979's disaster of a thing, SOS Titanic. Although in that one, the where I go, you go phrase is not in there. And also in 1997's Titanic, of course, but like I said, there's no evidence that they went back to their cabins. And there's actually a deleted scene with the Strausses in the 97 movie that's more specifically about what we know of this kind of mythological canon. In the aftermath, Ellen Byrd went on to work for the Speddens, and tragedy would follow her. And if you know anything about the Speddens, who were also on Titanic, unfortunately, you know Douglas Spedden was a child on board Titanic, but he would be killed in this freak car accident just a few years later. So Ellen Byrd, I just can't even imagine. She goes to this interview in London and then all of this happens. The fate of Macy's. The family remained in charge and eventually built it into obviously one of the largest chain department stores. I mean, literally everywhere. Isidore's son, Jesse, who was the one passing on the ship, the America, when Titanic happened, served as an ambassador to France and Macy's president for a long time. And I believe the last Strauss to work full-time running Macy's died in the 90s. I didn't write that down. I should have, but I read a little bit of that online. The Strauss house in Taubaton, from what I could tell, has been torn down, but there is a marker for it there. And it says, quote, here's, and this is in Georgia, I remember, here stood the frame house in which Lazarus Strauss and his family lived when they came to Taubaton in 1854. Seeking a new home in America after leaving Bavaria, Strauss visited Taubaton during a court week and decided to make his home among its hospitable people. His family, the only Jewish one in town, became identified with the progress of the community. The sons, Isidore, Nathan, and Oscar, studied at nearby Collinsworth Institute. Nathan and Oscar attended the Baptist Sunday School. So interesting. And more, it says more. Lazarus Strauss founded a mercantile business in Taubaton and a later one in Columbus. After the war between the states, he established a crockery and glassware business in New York, a forerunner of Macy's, which became, under the leadership of Isidore Strauss, one of the world's leading department stores. Oscar Strauss, among the earliest career diplomats, served as minister, ambassador, and cabinet member under Presidents Cleveland, McKinley, Roosevelt, and Taft. So as you can hear in that historical marker, which is written in the 1950s, and it's pretty obvious because it says the war between the states, there is so much to unpack in the story of the Strausses. Their familial history is in every, it's there applicable to every major theme of American history from the mid-1800s to the present. And I have done my very best to do some of it justice to, you know, I view these histories as little eggs, right? And if you're looking at the nice little pretty egg, and the egg is the story that you've, you know, that you read in your junior year of high school about what American history is, or maybe even a little bit in college, a pretty little egg. Here was the Civil War, you know, not pretty, but wrapped up and finished and somebody won and it's over. And I, the eggs have to be like all smashed and opened and running together for me to feel like I'm doing something right. And so today I wanted to smash some of those eggs open and show you what's inside. And Titanic, as always, is this incredible vessel, pardon the pun, to talk about race and class and gender and all of the themes of American history that make us who we are and help us to inform how we view the world. And if there has been a little bit of a tone of coldness or disappointment in this episode, full disclosure is because it's very hard for me to reconcile Isidore, his Confederate past with Isidore I've always heard about in terms of Titanic. But I think people can be nuanced and people can be more than just black or white. They can be gray. We're all gray. And I wanted to lay out the life of this couple. As you have just heard, a lot of the mythology is just right there ready to be busted open when it comes to them. And that's my job here. So I hope that it's been informative and helpful in understanding who they are and why we do mythologize some of the Titanic passengers. I think that's where I'm going to end it. I am not joking when I say that I will most likely get comments, emails, reviews about this episode. I take a lot of flack, especially on the Apple review section, for being really open and blunt about the darker parts of our history. But I will never stop doing that. And for those of you who appreciate it, thank you. And thank you for listening to everybody. If you are someone who does appreciate that this is a little bit more of a gritty is not the word, but blunt, maybe I'll use that word again. For those of you who do appreciate the bluntness by which I address all the themes related to Titanic and work so hard to relate them to the questions we have about ourselves and where we come from, then let me know, reach out. It's always encouraging to hear from people who do appreciate the mode at which I do this. I know I'm old enough and wise enough now to understand that I am not for everybody, but I do appreciate those of you who support what I do. And if you have a minute, you know, throw a rating on Apple or Spotify. That would be amazing. In the meantime, again, thank you for listening. There's lots more to come in October. I know September was a little bit of a slow month in the feed, but there's a ton more to come, including me talking to other people. I know sometimes the episodes where it's just me, without someone to sort of, you know, toss ideas around with, I think sometimes that's missing a little bit, which is why I do try to bring more and more guests on. But I've also heard from many of you that these deep dive episodes into passengers are important to you as well. So really going to try to do a mix of those for the season. And I'm going to go. Let's see, is there anything else to mention? Mugs are coming soon. Working with a couple of really amazing artists to try to get those out. Hopefully by the time it's like holiday shopping, I think that will be a really good time to release mugs. And they're not going to be just the podcast logo. It's some really amazing artwork that some artists I've connected with through Instagram have worked on and communicated to me about. And we're going to split the proceeds, and it's going to be a wonderful way to support the pod and artists. All right. Have a wonderful weekend, and I'll talk soon. Bye, guys.